I'm John Fund with the Wall Street Journal, and I've been given the honor of introducing our speaker. Doug Schoen is normally known in the political industry as a pollster, but we all know that as the advisors and the people around a candidate tend to have taken on a much bigger role in recent years and a much more public role, many of them in the industry see themselves as much more if they happen to be a pollster. Some see themselves as sort of just the numbers guy. You give the candidate the numbers, the candidate makes up his or her mind. Sometimes they see themselves as the spin doctors, sort of explaining away the candidate or explaining how the candidate can communicate with voters. Sometimes they see themselves as the campaign psychiatrist. Sometimes they see themselves as the chief strategist even, which sometimes upsets the chief strategist. But Doug Schoen is a little different. Having read most of his book, I've actually discovered that what Doug Schoen really is a great storyteller. This book is filled with wonderful stories. If you want to know how Ed Koch actually got to be mayor of New York City, if you want to know how an eight-year struggle to topple Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia succeeded without firing a shot, if you want to find out how Bill Clinton was able to go from the humiliating defeat of the 1994 midterm elections to winning re-election 2 years later, in fact, if you want to learn the background of a whole lot of interesting historical stories, you want to read this book. And of course, Doug also has some lessons for how candidates can appeal to voters, actually listen to them, which is, I think, one of the most important aspects of a campaign and one of the most neglected. And I also think Doug is going to give us some hints as to the surprises of 2008. Every presidential election, we have seen surprises come up that have transformed the campaign and almost no one foresaw. In 1992, we had the rise of the independent multimillionaire, Ross Perot, who literally changed the race. And in fact, was doing very well until that 60 Minutes interview and the entire American public discovered that his trade table wasn't in its full upright and locked position. But he did transform the race. In 1996, and this is where Doug Schoen comes in, Doug Schoen and his team calculated that the climate and the tone of a presidential election are not set in the year of the election, the even-numbered year, but in the odd-numbered year preceding it. And if you can change the climate and the tone and discredit your opposition in the year preceding the election, you're going to have two legs up when the actual election comes around. And that's what Bill Clinton was able to do with Doug Schoen's help and the help of others, and it transformed the 1996 campaign. In 2000, I think we saw front runners decide that they were going to lock up the nomination in terms of endorsements and in terms of money and in terms of early support in both the Democratic and Republican nominations. So both Al Gore and George W. Bush were de facto nominees long before anyone expected in most normal years. In 2004, we saw the rise of Howard Dean and the birth of the internet as a campaign vehicle, both in terms of disseminating information and building a platform and also in terms of collecting small donors outside of the traditional donor bases. So what are the surprises going to be for 2008? I freely confess I don't know, but I think we're already seeing one of those surprises, which is we're already seeing the rise this year of the non-candidacy candidacy, or the non-campaign campaign. Barack Obama launched his campaign as a non-candidate on Meet the Press when he hinted to Tim Russert that he was going to be running for president the same day his book went on sale. And his book ended up selling about 800,000 copies. Made him rich, built the enthusiasm for his campaign, so when he finally did announce in January, his non-campaign campaign had put him on a sound footing. We have two non-campaign campaigns going actively in the Republican Party. Newt Gingrich is actively non-campaigning for president. And he's using a 527 nonprofit group to disseminate his ideas just on the outside chance that maybe in September he'll run, which of course he will. And then you have the rise of Fred Thompson, who's campaigning, let's see, on Law & Order on Friday nights at NBC, who's campaigning on Paula Harvey on ABC Radio, who's campaigning all over the internet, but of course is not campaigning. So this is a rollicking year, and I can only imagine what other surprises are in store for us, and that's why it's such a pleasure and a privilege to get a sneak preview of that and Doug Schoen's book today from the author himself.
John, thank you very much for a very kind introduction, and certainly thanks to the Manhattan Institute, to Larry Moan and David DeRozier for inviting me today. I will do my best to live up to that introduction. I should begin by saying that I'm usually known as a Democratic pollster, but I was pleased to be joined at my table by Ned Regan, a former controller of New York State, a client of Penshone and Berland, and a Erie County executive, if my memory serves me. And I will begin by telling an inside story, and I cleared it with Ned, and he said I could reveal it to you. And when we were working with Ned, I think it was over two elections, Ned was an earnest, decent, hardworking client, responsive, solicitous, involved in what we did. But he did reveal his innermost thoughts, and I'm going to betray those confidences. And his innermost thoughts were a sense of outrage with the way the system worked in Albany. I think E.J. McMahon's statistical and analytical studies would bear out the outrage Ned contemporaneously expressed to us. But I would tell you, as a public official, it was a great honor to work with a public official like Ned. It was a great honor for me to have the chance to work with somebody who was as committed to the public good as Ned was and continues to be. I just wanted to say that, and I say that, obviously he's here, but there are not that many of my clients who I would feel compelled to say that about, and I'm pleased to be able to say it. Now I'll turn to the war stories that you came to hear. And John, the polling industry such as it is probably began in 1960, and the image that in our industry gets reported to sort of rookie pollsters is of John Kennedy soaking his back in a bathtub somewhere in West Virginia, Lou Harris sitting with a printout in front of him, reading numbers, telling John Kennedy what he should say and do, and Kennedy looks at him in a weary way and says, just the numbers, Lou. And I'd like to think we've gone further than that, and indeed, my book begins in 1971 with a election for district leader in East Harlem. And I was working with a unlikely coalition of New York political leaders led by the late Carter Burden, Father Louis Gigante, Herman Badillo, who were backing a now appellate court judge who opposed Frank Rossetti. And John, with all due respect, I did see vote fraud. They basically said, kid, get out of the way if you know what's good for you. And I did know what was good for me, and I did get out of the way. We lost that election 3-1. In that campaign, I met a man who lived in the neighborhood, what was called then and now a knock-around guy. Knock-around guy had a son named Anthony. Anthony is now running to go to the 2008 election, the campaign of Rudy Giuliani for President of the United States. So while all politics is indeed local, my first experience, and hopefully I don't look all that old, but my first experience was watching a three-year-old toddler crawl around a railroad flat at 115th and 2nd Avenue, and that toddler is now grown up into an adult and is potentially going to be one of the most powerful men in America, presumably, if he gets his way, the next Karl Rove. I think John is right that pollsters and political consultants come in a variety of different shapes, forms, and incarnations. We certainly would like to think of ourselves as doing more than just giving numbers, making commercials, quote, providing a service. And I'm proud that we've made a difference in elections. And what I'd like to do today, before I get to the subject that John asked me to address, and which I happily address, which is the 2008 election, I'd like to offer something of an analysis of what it is I think our business does, how we've been most effective, and where our business and the function we provide can be very useful to the struggle we are now facing as a nation. And I say all that because I believe that my proudest and most significant contribution is strengthening democracy around the world and democratic institutions. The book discusses in some detail an 8-year effort that I participated in, played a significant role to topple Slobodan Milosevic from power in Serbia. My own sense of it was that in 1992, in the interregnum between the Bush administration leaving office and Bill Clinton taking power, we had a legitimate chance to oust Milosevic in a democratic election. I believe, in fact, we created a candidacy, and we did oust him. We had exit polls that suggested that he'd lost. The problem was the Europeans were typically European. They didn't think the election was free and fair, but they didn't want to do anything. Their observers went home for Christmas. And the United States wasn't interested. You know, they'd fought a war in Iraq previously. President Bush was leaving office, and Bill Clinton was not in power. And then Secretary of State, or the Secretary of State-to-be, Cyrus Vance, I'm demonstrating my age. Former Secretary of State Cyrus Vance told me at the time he was more interested in advancing what was then the Vance-Owen plan than trying to do anything to oust Milosevic. So we won the election. Milosevic stole it. We knew it. The world sat by. And it took literally 8 years, another stolen municipal election, for us to use the same tools to turn Milosevic out. The bombing didn't do it. It was really activities such as that of my firm and others working to strengthen democratic institutions that promoted peaceful, what proved to be peaceful, transition to democratic rule in Serbia. And I say this not to suggest that the work that we do is a panacea, that all you need is pollsters, you don't need guns, you don't need more sophisticated techniques. Obviously you do. But as I look at the world and as I try to write an introduction to my book, I thought about the so-called axis of evil. And I realized that when we looked at Korea, I'd been involved in two elections in 97 and 2002, where we basically blew a chance to help elect forces in South Korea who stood up and stand for our proposition that it's bad for North Korea to have nuclear weapons, and it's bad for them to have untrammeled access to the currency markets as they do, and to engage in the kind of black marketing and trade that they do. And we basically took a pass on providing assistance to a candidate who saw the world in our terms, even after 9/11. That candidate understood that American interests were at stake, and he would ask me plaintively, where is the United States? I really didn't have much of an answer. And I'd like to think that, again, we'd be a more secure world with a more pro-American president in North Korea as we confront the ongoing menace in North Korea. In Iran, again, following, I think it was Michael Leadon's piece in the Wall Street Journal, or if I recollect correctly, we have systematically ignored the prospect of providing substantial ongoing assistance to the opposition. We didn't help the opposition when President Khatami was in office to any large degree. We haven't helped them much in the since the election of Ahmadinejad. And I would argue that when you're trying to make a case that there should be opposition to a government that is antithetical to our interests and the interests of normal, decent people, that to not use all the tools at our disposal is a very, very sad prospect. Obviously, the case of Iraq is a little different because we've had two successful elections. I think most of us would sit and say that those elections are probably high points in the move to transition to democracy in Iraq. And everybody except, I think, the most those who take the most extreme view would have to, I think, accept the proposition that we would be safer and better off if there was a stable democratic government that resulted from the process that removed Saddam Hussein. the limits of my business are such that you can have elections and people can vote and the votes can be counted freely and fairly, but if there's not power sharing and agreement on local institutions, you probably don't have enough to strengthen an enduring democratic system. And we could spend a lot of time talking about that, but I would say this: more work and more thought on building democratic institutions would, in my mind, in Iraq, would have done more to have made the process a better and more stable one. I think we all accept the possibility and hope that the Shiites are able to cooperate with the Kurds and the Sunnis on lasting institutions that offer an alternative to the chaos that appears to be emerging. So the lesson that I draw from this experience is that the industry that I have been part of can strengthen democracy and democratic institutions. One of the places I think had a little success, but if I thought about it, I would say I failed, would be in Venezuela. In 2004, with the help of the Wall Street Journal and some moderate to conservative commentators, we made the case that Hugo Chavez's revolution was a fraud, and the referendum on his continued service was a fraud as well. It's been statistically demonstrated that indeed it was a fraud. This most recently conducted election may or may not have had a fair count, but what it sure was a free and fair election. But I argue that Chavez has used the tools of democratic reform, the rhetoric of leftist populism, to try to hide the fact that he is trying to destabilize our hemisphere and pursue policies that are inimical to American interests. We had more success in countries like Mexico and the Dominican Republic in encouraging democratic transition. So it gives me confidence that, you know, as one individual, I've been part of a process that has, in large part, worked. Ukraine would be another example. They're going through tough times now. Georgia would be another example I wasn't personally involved in, but certainly where the industry and the work I do makes a difference. A couple of basic points. I think that one of the lessons I take from this is that exit polls matter. And lots of exit polls matter. And again, that may sound simple, but if you have an election and you don't count the votes fairly, you don't have a democratic result. I already spoke about Serbia. In the case of Ukraine, through my work and the work of other firms, a so-called rigged count was absolutely undone, and that led to Yushchenko's election directly, hugely important. So I guess what I would say is we have a tool that we've exported that I think has done a lot more good to promote democracy than most people recognize, and hopefully will be used more. And I draw from my own experience that promoting democratic institutions, exporting the tools of political consulting, understanding how people think, trying to develop policies that communicate in terms that people find responsive, will help the United States government advance ideals that I think are very important, and I suspect everybody here feels are equally important: freedom, liberty, democracy, goals that I think have universal applicability, and my work around the world seem to resonate very, very deeply. There are a couple of lessons for American politics that I draw. First, I'll talk about the practical, and then I'll turn to the unexpected challenges that John Fund mentioned. The simple conclusion that I reached that I haven't seen discussed much is that we don't have enough exit polls here. What's happened is for interests of cost, all the media does one exit poll. They all pay for the same poll. So where we used to have five or six polls, we have one poll. And it's the problem with socialism. You don't have competition. You don't have intellectual creativity. You have this one consortium, VNS, which does a poll which maybe is good and more likely is not good. And you have all the networks creating models based on data collection to try to predict quickly what the results are. And we've had problems with exit polls in the last two elections, and without getting into a long discussion of 2000 and 2004, I think it's fair to say that the problem is not the exit poll per se, but the fact that we're not getting enough information about how and why people vote as they do. We're not doing enough surveying, and we're not understanding American attitudes in a way that we can have more rather than less confidence in our democratic institutions. That being said, the other problem with our industry, which is one of the reasons John's question is such a good one, is we've been overtaken by horse race journalism. I mean, if we wanted to sit down and talk about, is Fred Thompson up? Is Newt Gingrich down? Where is Rudy Giuliani? Where is John McCain? Will Hillary be nominated? Will Barack Obama break through? We could spend all afternoon talking about an absurd number of polls, some of which are good, most of which are not so good, and just try to debate the polls. When I started, people didn't really even believe the telephone polls mattered. Now telephone polls are on the way to going becoming antiquated as we move towards internet-based data collection. So the world, in terms of my industry, is changing dramatically. But let me offer a couple of insights about 2008 that I think will at least stimulate a little conversation today. First, the whole notion of the non-candidate candidate that John mentions is a hugely important idea. And it's important for a couple of reasons. First, there is so much dissatisfaction that the American people want something new. They're not quite sure what that is or what form it can take. But if they hear something, a Fred Thompson may run, Newt Gingrich, Barack Obama, they're excited. We saw some evidence of that in 2004 that John didn't mention in the case of Wes Clark. Wes was a terrific candidate until he announced. The day after he announced and said he wasn't sure what he would do about the Iraq war, his campaign was over. So his campaign lasted one day. But until he became a candidate, he had the best operation going. And if you go back to 92, as John did allude to, Ross Perot was absolutely on a juggernaut until he decided that, yes, he would respond to people's entreaties and become a candidate. Excuse me. This says to me that there is a degree of underlying dissatisfaction in the American electorate that is very hard to quantify and very hard to put a precise number on. But when you look at the rhetoric of candidates like Hillary Clinton, who basically says, I'm really bipartisan, or you look at Barack Obama, who talks about the rhetoric of being a nonpartisan elected official, wanting to end rancor and bitterness and fighting, what they're really saying is, we know this system is broken. The 2006 midterm election was a victory for the Democrats, largely because they weren't Republicans. There's no great confidence in the Democratic Party. There's even less in the Republican Party. Voters feel the Republicans have failed. They feel the Democrats arguably offer an alternative, but not really one that they have enormous confidence in. So there could be surprises. And when I looked, as I think everybody did, at Joe Lieberman's election in 2006, I drew a slightly different conclusion than many. When Lieberman tried to be a Democrat, when he wasn't really a Democrat, his appeal fell on deaf ears. When Lieberman said he was an independent, all of a sudden, 60% of Connecticut voters responded enthusiastically to that appeal, and he ended up winning by 11 or 12%. So there's a desire in the American electorate for change. The other thing that I think is going on in America is people understand that the rules have changed. It used to be you worked for a company, you had a pension, you stuck with the company, you had health care, your kid would do better than you would do. It's all changed. People believe that all bets are off, the rules have changed, and the political leadership is trying to cope with that. How that will play out in the election, I don't think we know. One final point. John said that 2004 was the year of the internet and Howard Dean. It was. The thing that I've learned about politics is that the internet offers enormous capabilities to organize, fundraise, communicate with people in ways that are only dimly understood today. The politicians are playing catch up, and the disconnect between the voters on one hand, who want to participate, the community, the online community, and the online professionals, on the other hand, and the politicians, is virtually a complete disconnect. I said to John, if he wanted to run for office and had the resources, I knew of plenty of people, including myself, who could make sure that his campaign was a good one. But if you say, I want to maximize the utility of the internet to maximize my appeal and my support, it's a very, very difficult process with few providers. And that raises, again, other possibilities. Barack Obama, who has 103,000 donors as of the last report, could well have literally millions. And I believe that on the right, there could be similar organizing and financial support that pours forth. So all of which is to say we are in literally uncharted waters. I greatly appreciate your kind attention and patience listening to me ramble all over the world. I will happily take questions on any aspect of what I've talked about or about politics going forward, and I appreciate your kind attention. Yes, ma'am.
Will Mayor Bloomberg run?
You know, I think the honest answer is he doesn't know. He said he's not going to do it. I take him at his word. But we live in a sufficiently uncertain world that whether he takes the prospect seriously or not, my point today was to suggest there is an opportunity in the electorate for a third party. One name that is certainly possible is Chuck Hagel. And I think an anti-war Republican with military credentials would be a hugely successful candidate. And the reason why John Fund's comment about the non-candidate candidate is so important, everybody assumes that if somebody like Mike Bloomberg were to run, he'd be able to fund his campaign. And yes, he would. But assuming Mike sticks to his word, which I have no reason to believe he won't, but assuming he does, the question is, well, how does a candidate with no resources of his own raise money? Answer, if you hit a responsive chord, I can assure you, given the nature of the internet, literally within a few days you can have millions of dollars. That's number one. And number two, you want an organization around the country? Set up a website, set up an 800 number, and watch people respond. So I really think that there are any one of a number of possibilities that could change this system or change the electorate in ways that at this point are unpredictable.
Doug, could you repeat the question?
Oh, yes, the question, I'm sorry, and I apologize. The question was, would Mike Bloomberg run? And my answer was, whether he runs or not, I think there's a prospect for a independent force in politics to impact the election in ways that we just can't predict today. Yes, ma'am. Well, again, the question is, who are the bloggers? I mean, we work for a living. We're not sitting online writing commentary. Who are these people? Well, let's just say I'd much prefer to address an audience of supporters of the Manhattan Institute than an audience of bloggers. But that being said, what the bloggers prove is that disparate interests coming together, even in a virtual way, can have a disproportionate impact on the political system. The Ned Lamont primary victory in 2006 demonstrates that, at least to Democratic politicians, that the bloggers have something of a veto over the process. MoveOn had their own virtual primary a couple of weeks ago, and all the candidates participated. And what this says to me in a larger way is an interest that is incoherent coming forward in the course of an election can influence things in ways that it's just very hard to predict. But they have a convention, the bloggers, each summer. I think appropriately enough, in Las Vegas was the last one, and I'd urge you not to go. Yes, sir.
Why is there an assumption that Mitt Romney can't overcome the Mormon issue on a nationwide election when he was effectively able to do so in Massachusetts?
Well, the question is, why isn't Mitt Romney assumed to be able to overcome the Mormon issue? A couple of reasons. First, the poll data is now showing that being a Mormon is apparently, and because polls on this subject are very, very difficult to put a great deal of validity in, they show by a factor of two or three times that it's worse to be a Mormon than a woman or an African American. Now, what that means, you know, what that means. I haven't met any, but by the time this election's over, we may have one. But so again, that's a poll question, and I don't know if I put a lot of stock in it. But that's the superficial answer to your question. The other problem that I see for Mitt Romney is as somebody who has changed his position recently on abortion and stem cell and guns, and apparently forgot to get his hunting license before he was a hunter. I think there is an issue of credibility that emerges that could well be a problem in a Republican primary. The one countervailing force, which I don't know the answer to, is given that no one is taking public finance, whether Mitt Romney will decide to spend $300 million on February 5th. Now, he can make that decision. And if he makes it, I would argue that given the nature of political communications in the states that will have primaries on February 5th, that if he decides to put $50 million into California, $50 million into Florida, maybe he wouldn't invest in New York, but say into Texas, I think we could see an impact. And I believe he'll be able to be successful continuing to raise money, but for him to emerge, I would argue, he will need to spend a disproportionate amount of his personal resources to have a real chance. Yes, sir. You know, it's an interesting question whether the empowerment of those who use the web will disempower minorities or working class people. I guess I'd say a couple of things. First, 70% of America is online. Second, there was a piece in the Post, I don't know if any of you saw it, it was a cover story, New York Post, about 10 days ago, about the doorman who went online and made his first political donation to Barack Obama, sent $25 or $50. And I guess my reason for reporting that anecdotal bit of information, the web penetration is sufficiently strong that I think we can reach enough of the electorate online that anyone who wants to participate can. It's a question of tapping an issue constituency and a group in a way that arguably is bold and different. And I guess what I would say is there's certainly the prospect for what you say happening, but it's not clear to me that that will necessarily be the result. Yes?
Doug, regarding your efforts in foreign elections, you had mentioned that we missed opportunities to influence elections. I'd like you to detail what we could have done, because if you were the director of the Central Intelligence Agency and you said to a group, we have to do more to influence foreign elections, I think there'd be hearings going on.
Well, I'll tell you my Central Intelligence Agency story, which to me was just, befuddling, I guess is the best word I could use. Right before the 2000 election, I went on a Council on Foreign Relations trip to the CIA. So I saw George Tenet, whose book I guess will be out next week. And I said, you know, I've done this polling in Serbia and basically saying to myself, you know, you guys haven't always gotten it right. Maybe I can be of some help. I said, that's terrific. So he arranged for me to come down and meet with their analysts. So I met with their analysts in, I guess, February or March of 2000. And it was a pleasant enough meeting. I saw a couple of the analysts were people I'd seen in 92 who were working in the embassy. And again, that was fine. But they suggested to me that Milosevic could not be beaten by democratic means. Now, the resources of the CIA vastly exceeded the resources that were being put at my disposal, But I suggested that I thought our survey work was dispositive. And they argued respectfully, and within 2 or 3 weeks of my presentation, a concerted effort was underway at the highest levels of the State Department to close down our project, which was being partially supported by the National Democratic Institute. And I said to myself, if the CIA, with the vast resources they have, can't quite figure this out, you know, we're really in sorry shape. And I don't purport to be an expert on intelligence, but, you know, I can add two and two, and I could figure out, with Milosevic having an approval rating somewhere about where George Bush's rating is now, that he was ripe for the plucking. So I guess what I would say is I see it less as sort of surreptitiously pulling strings and more working with people who share our values to help them organize their citizens in ways that, broadly speaking, reflect policies and interests that we want to support. And if we're prepared to go overseas with guns and threaten people and use sanctions to try to support our policies, why would we not want to support, using the tools of freedom, liberty, and democracy, people and policies that we're comfortable with? David. The basic question is there a disconnect between the people and the parties? Where are we in terms of the parties and the electorate and sort of what's going on? I think there is a tremendous disconnect. I think the parties are seen as being out of touch, not offering solutions to the problems facing the American people, and beyond not offering solutions, not offering common sense approaches to the kind of problems people face. People don't talk about their concern in terms of, well, I want to move towards negotiation on Medicare Part D. They don't talk that way. They don't talk about the problems that they face in terms of healthcare as, I want universal care. They'd say, I'm worried my kids aren't covered. I'm worried about my parents. I'm worried that I can't afford good quality care. What do we do? But the sort of red state, blue state mentality that we see in our politics is really antithetical to the way the American people think about the issues of the day. And from my perspective, the reason why I see the political terrain as being so uncertain is the political class talks one language, the electorate talks another language, and since there's such little overlap or connection, the level of dissatisfaction is so strong and the degree of anger with partisan fighting so high. Yes, sir.
Yes, it is a related question in a way, but there's been a tremendous drop-off in support for George Bush and for Republicans over the last 2 years. This is a guy who won more presidential votes than any candidate in history. What, in your view, are the chief factors driving this drop-off in support? Is it the Iraq War or is it a concatenation?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's the Iraq War. And I think that whether your perspective be one that you supported the war, opposed the war, it's very hard to argue that the war has been a success. David's question was sort of how do the American people think about politics and policy? And they want results. They're really not interested in ideology. They want to win. I mean, they're not hawks or doves. They're people who sort of say, we're spending all this money. We've lost all these lives. What are we getting for it? What's the payoff to us? And so I think that the situation in Iraq has undermined the basic argument of the Bush presidency, which is, I'm going to keep you safe and make you strong. And I think there's enough uncertainty with the economy, not so much in terms of the stock market or people's level of employment, but basically the notion of David Brooks had a column a couple of weeks ago talking about things in terms of security. I think people feel insecure about their lives and the lives of their children, and I think they're not reassured that the Bush policies are enhancing their security either at home or abroad. So I think people are just nervous, and I think that really gets at what they're looking the to the political class to address. Tom?
Doug, what do you see as the future of dead tree newspapers and magazines?
Sure.
Do you see their influence going down in the last few campaigns you've run? And if the Huffington Post endorsed somebody, would that carry more weight than some print publication?
I was going to say perhaps Sam Zell could answer that question. But putting that aside, it's a very good question, and I have an equivocal answer. I think that the print press leads the day still in setting the agenda. And the cable news networks defer to a much greater degree than I would have ever imagined to print. That being said, how we define print is changing. Woman who is doing my PR for this book and doing a great job for me, Sarah Birmingham, her husband is, I think, the editor of the front page of the online edition of the New York Times. And my reaction when she told me that was to say that job is at least as important as being a senior editor of the print edition of the New York Times, simply because the nature of what a newspaper is has changed so radically. So I believe, Tom, that the print press, and perhaps less so the magazines, but certainly the dailies, are going to remain influential. But the nature of how their information will be consumed, I think, is changing. The other thing we've seen from our research, and I think this is a subject that has not been studied in any great detail but is worthy of serious treatment, is the way perhaps we in this room would consume information and the way people under 30 would consume information. And if there are people under 30, I apologize for the offense. But, most of the people I know and who I've studied under 30 don't use print in the conventional form. They will go online. They will look at websites. They'll look at late-night television, Daily Show, et al. And their whole take on information is a very different one. But that being said, I don't think print is going to lose its influence anytime soon. Yes, sir?
Do you see any indications of backlash to the voters, to the amount of enormous amounts of money that are being raised by all these candidates?
I see backlash less to the money than to the cacophony of the campaign process. I mean, we're going to go through another 18 or 19 months of this. I think the amount of time that will be devoted to serious discussion of the issues will be relatively limited. And I think that there is a very good chance that the candidates will do what we frequently encourage candidates to do, which is to attack one another rather than talk about the issues, simply because that's the way you both get votes and get headlines, or maybe get headlines to get votes. So I think that we run the prospect that this election could well end up embittering as many people as it empowers. And I think that the process itself with a literally full two-year campaign is not necessarily all that healthy for our democratic system. Sir? Yeah, I think really the issue of advancing the primaries goes to the last questioner's issue. It requires the candidates to raise a large sum of money sooner. We will have a nominee, I suspect, after February 5th, barring some unforeseen circumstance. And when we have, when and if we have nominees in mid-February and we have 6 or 7 months until we get to the conventional and traditional Labor Day start of the campaign, I believe that we run the risk of really just having two sort of wearied candidates sort of slogging it out, struggling over the finish line with the American people the loser. Yes, sir.
On your point that survey research shows that Americans feel the rules have changed.
Yeah.
You're not going to stay with the same company and all of that. How do you think that affects voters' expectations of the role of government? Do they want a single-payer health care system? Particularly, what would you advise the Democratic Party
Again, very good question, which is, does this uncertainty translate into support for a more expansive government, single-payer health care? And curiously enough, it doesn't. What it translates into is a sense that they want solutions to the problems without large government. The American people really are not looking for redistributive policies. They're not looking for big government to solve problems. They're looking for government to be a partner with business, with labor, with interest groups to fashion solutions so that people have results that meet their needs. So what I have advised the Democrats, and probably I'm in a distinct minority, is don't really push for big government solutions that are unlikely to succeed. Push incrementalism that will produce concrete results that you as Democrats can take credit for, because the Republicans are usually so nervous about pursuing anything that smacks of government intervention. So I believe that we are certainly in an era where people want government to play an affirmative role, but it's not necessarily the role that some of the more activist Democrats would want it to be. Yes?
You have disparaged the integrity of the results of the election in Venezuela.
Yes.
But at the same time, our former president was on the scene and came to opposite conclusions.
Yes.
Is the former president working with the same data or have a different agenda, or how would you explain it?
I have a tough time explaining it. I guess what I would say is in 2004, working off the same data that I was privy to, and perhaps some other, he decided that the election was free and fair. There's been 2 years worth of academic studies, 2.5 years worth of academic studies done on that referendum, which has concluded that it would be about a 1 in a billion chance that the results were as Hugo Chavez said they were. And to this day, Jimmy Carter has not questioned those results. What I have seen since the December 3rd, 2006 election in Venezuela has suggested to me the very great likelihood that there was systematic wholesale fraud. And even if that not be the case, the institutions of communications in Venezuela were so heavily monopolized by Chavez and his agents. State government was used to literally drag the vote out for the incumbent president. Chavez, with his four-hour-a-day broadcasts, I think probably needs no great discussion. I am hard-pressed to understand how Jimmy Carter could or would ratify that election. It saddens me deeply that he would, but I can't answer your question. Larry? Well, the question is, how would I evaluate the performance of Arnold Schwarzenegger? I think if you looked at his reelection campaign, where he, again, ran on the kind of themes I'm talking about, he resuscitated a political career that before the election many thought was doomed to make him basically just a one-term or part of a one-term governor. And I guess my reason for putting it that way is I believe there's a chord and a current in the American electorate, something that, you know, John Fund's initial question raised, of deep dissatisfaction and a desire for a pragmatic, nonpartisan decision-making that the electorate responds to affirmatively because it's so very different from what we're seeing. And I think there's an appeal that even goes beyond the decisions themselves or the policies themselves, because it reflects a great desire and an untapped sentiment inside the electorate.
I think this needs to be the last question.
Oh, okay. Yes, sir.
There's been a lot written about the rise of illiberal democracy.
Yes.
The use of manipulated elections, yep, and so on to really legitimize authoritarian governments.
Correct.
Is this a rising trend? Do you expect more of this in
the
years?
I think the aspect of the problem that I did not suggest is the one that Jim Hoag's question raises, which is illiberal democracy a problem, and is the use of democratic norms and democratic institutions to legitimize effectively corrupt rule on the rise? And I think not only is it on the rise, it is one of the reasons why my industry, why exit polls, political communication is so important, because I think it is a tool that people on the left and the right use. Certainly, I think Hugo Chavez is a brilliant practitioner of it. I would say that he deserves an A-plus for political manipulation, and we've just been slow to recognize what he does. But the whole essence of what we do, and what I've tried to suggest today, is that we can strengthen real democratic institutions and promote American interests at the same time by encouraging real democracy and trying to expose illiberal authoritarian democracy or pseudo-democracies when they appear. Thank you.